This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.
The River Blackwater flows through Kerry, Cork and Waterford. It rises near Slieve Lucra, a mountain of rushes in Kerry, and runs east through Mallow and Fermoy in Cork. The river enters Waterford and flows through Lismore before abruptly turning south at Cappoquin, finally meeting the sea at Yall Harbour. In the fifth part of our series, Blackwater Life and Lodgings, we continue our trip up the River Blackwater, visiting the historical houses and landmarks that inhabit its banks, examining how the river has shaped the lives of the people and families who call these banks home. Leaving Camp Fear behind, the crew head towards Dromana, but first they pass the remains of a 19th century sailing vessel.
Here, on our western side, we see the frames of a vessel sticking up out on the side of the bank. This particular wreck was always known as the Ballinacorra, and there was a vessel built in Yall in the 1800s called the Ballinacorra Lass. Now, whether there's any connection between the two of them or not, I don't know. But it would be nice to think that maybe a boat built in Yall was eventually used as a landing stage here on the river itself and has ended our days there.
Maeve arrives in Dromana. The house stands proudly on a rocky outcrop perched high above the river. For over 500 years, Dromana was the seat of the Fitzgerald family, Earls of Desmond.
In 1215, Thomas FitzAntony got a grant of custody of the area called Dieshies and Desmond. The seventh Earl died in 1462, and he gave his son Gerald the area known as Dieshies between the River Mahon and Blackwater. Now, this area consisted of several thousand acres of land. Then his granddaughter died in 1604, and she was known as the Old Countess of Desmond because it was said that she lived to be 140. And not alone that, but she's said to have died as a result of a fall from a cherry tree at nearby Affan, which is just a little bit further up the river. Then in 1664, it passed to Catherine Fitzgerald, and she was only 13 at the time. And her guardian at that particular time was Lord Power of Corramore in Waterford. And he had a son who was aged 7. So he got the Bishop of Canterbury to marry them because he really wanted to get his hands on the Dromana lands. She later had the marriage dissolved and Catherine went and married a man called Edward Villiers. And he was a son of Viscount Grandison. And then in 1721, the estate passed into the Grandison family. Now, the Earl of Grandison, who lived at Dromana, he made numerous changes from about the 1740s on. He started many industries, small industries in the area. He brought the flax industry to Villierstown, which was a village that he had built. And he imported workers from the north of Ireland who were already familiar with the growing of flax. Part of what we're looking at there, that's the only part of the house that now remains. Part of it was demolished in the 1960s. And the older part, actually, of the house is what remains.
At Dromana, the crew are welcomed into the house by Emily Villiers-Stewart. Emily first came to Dromana when she married James Villiers Stewart in the middle of the last century and presently gives visitors guided tours of the estate.
We've had a lot of female inheritances in this house. I mean, from the 1457 Tower House, when that was built, Barbara, my daughter, is actually the 21st generation to be born here of the same family. But there have sometimes been only girls. So when the girl married, of course, the name changed a little bit. But I always say the blood is the same. Originally, it was a tower house, which was off the balcony. And then in the 1640 rebellion, the rebels broke in and they fought over it for 7 years, and the top was completely destroyed, and so they had to pull it down. But the base is still there today, and they contemplated rebuilding, but then they said no, warring days weren't quite so bad, so they would build a house going from the river inwards. And they did this until, according to Smith's History of Waterford, a more commodious house could be built. And then in the 1740s, the Georgian front was built. Then, as I say, in the 1960s, that came down, which was very sad, but had to be, because it was just impossible to keep the roof on, everything like that. Catherine Fitzgerald was a daughter only, and her parents died very young. So she was brought up by her grandparents, and she married a gentleman called Edward Villiers, who, in fact, was the nephew of the famous Barbara Villiers, who was Charles II's mistress. And then they had children, and their eldest son was created the first Earl of Grandison. They had been viscounts before that. And he built Villierstown and the church, and he brought down the weavers from the north of Ireland to teach the people here how to weave the linen. He really built it for, he knew the people who were going to come down to do the work. And each house in Villierstown originally was named for a certain family when he built the village. And you have Bleach, which is another house, and that is because they used to bleach the linen to make it white. You have the Chlorine River, because they used to put chlorine into the water to make the linen good, and all these names are from that time. And then he built the church, and of course, being from the north of Ireland, the church was a Protestant church, because they were all Protestants and they're coming down. It lasted for about 100 years, the business, and then sadly it folded. I think there were quite a lot of linen setups in the south of Ireland by then. John Tracy, then, of course, everybody knows about, his wonderful Olympic medal, gold medal. And he was born in Villierstown, and his parents were wonderful people. His father's only died quite recently. When he was training, he used to do his running actually through the woods coming up to Drumanagh quite often. He always says it was the hills and things that helped him going up and down. So when it comes to the 1820s, you see Lord Stuart de Decies was the chap who inherited Drumanagh. He was very helpful to Daniel O'Connell in the Waterford election, and I think helped sway the winning of it, which helped to pass the Catholic Emancipation Bill. And we actually have the desk at which Daniel O'Connell and Lord Stuart de Decies drafted the plans for Catholic emancipation on.
In the 1950s, due to economic circumstances, Emily and her husband, James Villiers Stuart, had to reluctantly leave the house, but vowed to return to their ancestral home at some stage.
There's a newspaper cutting I have that when we left in the 1950s, James was being interviewed, and he said, oh, I'll be back. And he often said, I don't know why I said that, because I never really thought we would, but here we are. And he was very happy to come back. The house was not in a very good state. We had builders in really nearly for 2 years, putting down new floors and new joists and all sorts of things. We didn't do a good job on the roof. We didn't re-roof it, but we repaired the roof quite well, but it will have to be re-roofed sometime. Today, of course, it's wonderful because Barbara and Nicholas are living here as well, and we have two apartments which we rent for self-catering. The house and gardens are open to the public April, May and June, so people can come and see it and have a little history tour if they're interested in history about the family from the 1457 when they came back again. we were delighted to come back, and lovely to think that our daughter Barbara and her husband and children will live here too afterwards, we hope, and it will carry on, and of course another female inheritance.
Emily's daughter, Barbara Grubb, along with her husband Nicholas, now look after the day-to-day running of the house.
I sort of breezed in a few years ago. I to and froed because I was living in Tipperary with my husband Nicholas at Castle Grace, which is his family home. And then when my dad became ill, I said to Nicholas, now I've done my 30 years for you. You come and do 30 years for me. So we moved here to Dromana. We're trying to make Dromana pay for itself, difficult as it is in these times, and to that end, we want to share the house and the grounds as much as we can, because it's no advantage to us on our own. We just love to share the bit of history and the views and everything else. We pride ourselves on having one of probably the most spectacular views anywhere. I say in Ireland, some people say in the world. It really is. The Blackwater is considered to be the Rhine of Ireland. Our two apartments sit beautifully looking down upon the river, north and south. Nearly every window has a view of the river. We welcome as many guests and visitors as we possibly can, both to the garden, the house. My mother does a fantastic historical tour of the house. We will happily give people a cup of tea and a scone if they come along. We have a little slideshow which we're happy to show them of the other scenes of the Blackwater. Then the tour of the garden, which people could put away an afternoon quite easily, walking around the garden, picnicking on the way, or just taking in the wildlife and the flora and fauna, effectively. Both my mum and I feel that calling it a garden is a little bit rich, because actually it's we like to call it a woodland walk. It's a natural woodland walk, 30 acres of looped paths which are laid out on a terrace down to the river. Originally laid out by, we think, sort of the first Earl of Grandison, or maybe even slightly before that, and the terraces were grassed, and must have been quite some job to sigh to keep the grass trimmed. And I always say our soil, you could nearly eat it. It's so wonderful. It's just years and years and years of leaf mould and whatever. Things grow very, very easily. We're blessed. It felt absolutely fantastic to come here. There's a sort of sense of belonging. I think the family belongs on this rock. It's not about the house, it's about the rock, really. The location is spectacular. There's a great sense of pride that people have managed to keep it going up until now, and a huge sense of responsibility to try terribly and keep it going for the next generation, because our son Alexander is extremely keen to follow on.
Just above Dromana, at the end of a bridge spanning the Finnish River, stands the curious structure of Dromana Gate, built in the Hindu Gothic style.
It is said that in 1826, Henry Villiers Stuart married Caroline Ott of Vienna. And when they got married, supposedly they went off to see the Royal Pavilion in Brighton, which is built in the Hindu Gothic style. And they were so impressed with it that they had drawings of it sent back to the house before they came back after their honeymoon. And then to impress them when they came back, it is said that the workers on the estate had a similar arch to the one that's at Brighton built on the entrance when they were coming in. And that they were greatly, greatly impressed with this. And they decided that they would have a permanent structure made. And then this is how the Hindu Gothic arches were built. But in reality, the drawings for it exist. And in actual fact, it wasn't built until after 1849. Because the date on the drawings that were drawn up by the architect who was engaged to do it. The job was a man called Martin Day, and his drawings show that they're dated 1849. Also, the late James William Stewart, who lived at the house, he said that in actual fact, that driveway was built in order to connect the estate with the new railway that was being built between Waterford and Lismore.
I remember the actual Hindu Gothic gate when I was 17 or 18 years old, and an old lady living in one side of it, and she cooked on the other side of the road. It was two small apartments, but she actually cooked at one side, and she slept in the other. And her job was to close the gates every night going into the estate. And one needed a ticket or pass to pass through the whole estate. And the same applied below at the Villastown end of it.
The penultimate stop on the cruise journey is Turin House and Castle. Turin Castle was an old stronghold of the Roaches in the 17th century, and the estate eventually passed into the hands of the Jameson family, famous for their whisky, made in nearby Middleton.
It was occupied at one stage by Edmund Roach, but Edmund Roach lost it during the Cromwellian settlements, and it was taken over by the Nicholas family in 1654. The lands here then later passed to the Musgraves, who had come over from Wortley in Yorkshire. The Musgraves also owned the lands at Salterbridge near Capoquin, but this passed out of the family at a later stage by marriage. Sir Richard Musgrave was very active in around the time of the famine, when he was on various commissions. He did his very best to alleviate the suffering of the people who were dying from starvation around the 1840s, 1846 particularly was the known as the year of the famine. He was unusual in that he joined forces more or less with the local people. He said they were right to riot in towns like Yall because of the scarcity of food, particularly when there was an abundance of corn exported down the Blackwater River and out through Yall for delivery over to Great Britain. He did his very best for the people. He set up soup kitchens in Capoquin. They fed people from the estate itself. And he was chairman of the Relief Commission that operated from Lismore. The Musgraves were involved in building a new house, an early Victorian house, dates from around 1840, and that house is built some distance from the castle. Now, no one seems to know why there are two entrances to the entrance front of the house, but recently an old photograph turned up which actually showed that there was just one entrance door at the front of the house when the house was built. So it really is a puzzle as to why it was altered at some stage, and two very fine entrance doors put at each corner of the entrance to the house itself. Presently, the Jameson family that live at Turin have the house open by appointment to visitors, and the gardens are also opened. There's a very, very fine garden, particularly a spring garden, which is planted with several different interesting varieties of rhododendrons and azaleas. The garden then extends more or less down as far as the river. The present owners, as I said, opened the house by appointment. The three sisters, the Jameson sisters, are three artists. Three of them have exhibited widely, and Andrea Jameson has literally exhibited in Italy, Newfoundland, America, all over the place. And then her younger sister, who also paints on china, has exhibited extensively as well.
Maeve and her crew reached the end of their journey at Cappoquin House. Built in 1779 for local landlord Sir Richard Keane, it has been the home of the Keane family for over two centuries.
They were part of the O'Cahan clan of Derry, and they were Catholics. The O'Cahans fought against the English, and one at least fought with the Catholics at the Battle of the Boyne in 1690. Now, as a result of this, of course, they lost their lands and lost their possessions. But the penal laws then came in very quickly after 1690, which meant that Catholics were barred from all the professions. They were barred from owning land. They were only allowed a very short tenancy in various parts of the country. However, George Keane, who was Seosha O'Cahan, he turned Protestant and he was anglicised to the name from O'Cahan to Keane, and he was able to study law. Then in 1737, George Keane, he retired and he leased land from the Earl of Cork. Then in the 1770s, he had a house built, what looked exactly like the present house, but then the house was actually burnt down in 1923 by the Irregulars that were opposed members of the Free State Government of the time. Sir Richard Keane of the time was a member of the Free State Government, and he did apply to have the house rebuilt, and he was compensated by the government of the time as well, and it took 4 years to rebuild the house. But they altered the house a little bit. One of the things they did was they actually made the entrance front at the back, and then they developed the front of it as a garden which looks down over the town.
In 1881, a foundry was established at Cappoquin House, becoming a major employer in the area.
Sir Richard and his brother, M.F. Keane, set up the iron foundry, and it's actually in the site of the present co-op. Now, they were well actually qualified to set up an iron industry because Sir Richard was actually a civil engineer and M.F. Keane was a structural engineer. There was a history, of course, of ironworks in Cappoquin. The Earl of Cork had a smelting works at Cappoquin, so it was really the revival of an old industry. But they also had a good river for transport. There was also a good road and a railway. It started off in a very small way, just in a shed, and they set up to manufacture ironmongery and casting for contractors. And they employed a very small staff of moulders at first, and then eventually they began to make small, complete machines for farm work. However, at the Cork Exhibition in 1883, they won two awards for the machinery that they had made. And in 1894, Egan's Guide to Industry quotes a figure of 120 people working in the plant. Eventually, they produced very, very good farm machinery. They invented a mowing machine. They also manufactured reapers, wheel rakes, tumble rakes, and a whole lot of cast metal farm machinery that was extremely well made. So well made, in fact, that quite a lot of it survives to this day. Soldiers from Cappoquin, who actually enlisted and went out and fought in the Boer War in South Africa, came across pieces of machinery with the Keane name stamped on it. They made ploughs as well, but the ploughs were exported to Russia at one stage, and the Russians were so impressed with them that one of them came over and questioned them about how actually they were made, and they gave a demonstration, and they put down a whole row of pegs of timber in the ground, and the ploughs actually sheared through the timber. They were so well made. Eventually, the industry went into decline for a number of reasons, but the main reason was the river began to silt up, and that prevented large boats from getting up to Cappoquin. And then it was sold to the Pearces in Wexford, and the Pearces in Wexford only kept it going for a short period of time when it actually closed down. The Keanes are also noted for having leased the lands to set up the Cistercian monastery at Mount Mellery in 1832. It was an Irish abbot was in charge in Brittany. and they were being driven out of Brittany, and he came over to Ireland. His name was Vincent Ryan. So Richard Keane saw an opportunity of renting really, really rough mountain land at an area called Scrahan. They got 600 acres, and they got it for 1 shilling per acre for 20 years, and then a half a crown for the next 79 years. The monks actually set about making the land fertile, but it said also that a lot of the local people, when they saw the monks in distress and trying to make good agricultural land out of mountain land, they all went and helped them. So, and they did it voluntarily. But eventually the monastery was built. But Sir Richard Keane saw it as an opportunity as well, of course, that local people would see that you could farm on land like that, because he had quite a lot of mountain land that wasn't bringing him in very much rent. And he thought this was a good idea to have the monks working amongst the local people. And so that's what did happen. And a lot of the land up around Mount Mellery from that particular time was made fertile by people watching the methods that the monks brought with them from Brittany.
And so concludes the cruise journey along one of Ireland's most beautiful and unspoiled rivers. A river steeped in tradition and culture, which has shaped the lives of those who live along it.
I suppose what I like most about it is the sense of age that you get when you travel on the Blackwater. It's a very ancient place. You know that the trees are very old, that the houses are very old, and that it sort of links you with your ancestors going way, way back in this country, the comings and goings of people. As well, of course, visually it's very beautiful, and it's constantly changing. No 2 days are ever the same. When you go out, if it's a calm evening, the water can be like glass, and you can see the reflections of the trees in the water. Other times it can be fairly rough. It's also changing because of the tides. The tide is coming in and the tide is going out. And that changes the view every time. It's never, ever the same.
Everyone on the banks of the river made their living off of it, because it was the thoroughfare then. It was the moon of Munster. The River Blackwater is just home. It's just some place that one can feel very content alongside. One can have an awful lot of sport on. It's fun respected. The river is steeped in history and it has tremendous potential. That's basically what draws me to it.
Asher, there's a timelessness about it, I suppose, and that there's history falling out of every nook and cranny of it. And I suppose it's like a time capsule. It really kind of encapsulates our history, and it's absolutely beautiful, and it's unspoiled, and you know, the trees there coming down to the river edge. I've seen people going up there with a lot of anxiety and angst written on their faces, and by golly, an hour and a half later they seem to be a lot more relaxed. I feel really privileged to be doing this job, because it's in a town that I love, and on a river that I love. And well, if I'd not gone too far, I'd almost pay to do it.
Blackwater Life and Lodgings was produced by Noel Cronin, narrated by Mervyn Scott, researched by Angela Kearns, and edited by Sean Healy.
This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.